TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I knew there was something. I called the ambulance. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, had I just actually put him in the car myself right away? That's a horrifying thought, right? But what I did instead is I called the ambulance because I thought an ambulance knows what to do.
From the TED family of podcasts, this is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. On this episode, Debbie talks with designer and teacher Lori Haycock Makala about her partnership with her late husband, the designer P. Scott Makala, and about her own recovery from a brain injury.
I still feel like I'm recovering because I still have a lot of little glips and glaps that come up. It's just part of how where you recover to, or the place you go to feel better.
Design is generally thought of as a visual, spatial discipline. Sure, there's a sound design for movies and podcasts, and there is information design. But most graphic design simply doesn't engage more than our sense of sight. What about our sense of touch? Our sense of taste, our intuitive sense that there are other beating hearts out there in the world. Lori Haycock Makala is a designer who is interested in involving a range of sensory experiences. Recently, she was one of six installation designers to participate in an exhibit of multi-sensory and immersive experiences at the Dallas Museum of Art. The exhibit is called Speechless, Different by Design, for which she also designed the book. Lori joins me today from her home in Carson City, Nevada, to talk about that and about her extraordinary career in design for this very special episode of Design Matters for the Bend Design Conference in Bend, Oregon. Lori Haycock Makala, welcome to Design Matters.
Hi, Debbie. Thank you.
Hi.
That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Lori, is it true that you now live next to the original Pony Express Depot?
Yes. Well, because it's a small town, so you can actually, there's a lot of memorials and different things that recognize that moment. And I just think it's awesome that I'm here. I can work here, like you and I can talk, internet going. Everybody's dialed in, but I'm literally, when I think about where I am with the Pony Express, you know, kind of started, I think, whoa, 100 years later, this is what it is. And we get to just sit and with no pants on and do this sort of thing.
Looking at the stars.
Yeah.
Your daughter, Carmela Makala, is an up-and-coming director, and I read that she recently worked on a video for the musician Gary Clark titled When My Train Pulls In, and she's known for her provocative work, having previously shot a steamy video for Atmosphere's Ain't Nobody. And I read that on set, she created a unique family work ethic, bringing her vision to a high level of craft and emotional power. And I'm wondering how you influenced her work ethic, this family work ethic.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so surprised that you are mentioning that, talking about my daughter, which is lovely, and my kind of family. And I will tell you what's interesting, and therefore you might want to not talk about this. But my daughter learned, yes, from her dad, super inspiring, although he passed away when she was 8, and the whole vibe in the family, and her, my nephew, her uncle, Vincent Haycock, is a very kind of a famous, I don't know, film director in Los Angeles, and he was really her mentor. So it kind of went generational. Vincent studied with me when I was working at Cranbrook. He learned, 16-year-old kind of hanging around Cranbrook. Then my daughter was old enough and he took her on. But the postscript to that is my daughter turns out that, and this is just true confession, she's super talented, and that's why I'm so moved that you brought that up. And she kind of went into LA and filmmaking and all that hardcore. But, the LA life and the expectations in film and all that stuff that you mentioned, like how cool is it? How hot it is? Do you have the best director? Do you have the best artist? Do you have blah, 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 blah. She was really, ultimately, she just said, I don't like this. So if you ask me next why I'm in Carson City, Nevada, my daughter said, let's get out of here. We packed up. We got in a car, felt Thelma and Louise style. We went to Nevada and just started driving. She met a guy in Carson City and we moved here, and she just left everything. She just had a baby. She's married. She just loves it. She has nothing to do with the film world. End of story.
Wow. What an incredible story. And once,
talked about it like that ever, because it is kind of like that. Wait, she just said, you know what? I want to have a family and have a regular life and live in just a mellow place. And I was
well,
like,
I think it's just so interesting because that family work ethic is similar to, I think, the family creative ethic in the way that you've reinvented and moved and had such different, vibrant chapters of your life, which we're going to talk about. So I think it's really interesting.
That is a segue, because it is, when I saw what she was doing, she went from having when you said steamy, I like that word. She kind of had this steamy career moving, and her cousin Vince was like going, go girl, we need women in film, blah, 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 blah. And she was like, I know I'm supposed to do this, but actually here's what I really want to do. Is everybody okay with that? And she said, Mom, I know your 70s feminist is freaking you out. And it did, because it did. And then I was like, you know what? Thank God you are choosing this other way of life that also makes sense. And
well, yeah, a 70 feminist set up a scenario where women should be able to choose.
And yes, so exactly. And I had to work myself off that cliff and say, wait, what is this? And she said, Mom, I understand that this is kind of like counterintuitive or whatever. But family is family, and getting a grip on having a life that you like, that's a thing. I respect that. So, yeah, it's crazy you mentioned that. So thank you.
Lori, you grew up in Woodland Hills, California, in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
And one of your brothers is a Zen monk.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
Oh, wow. You are good, dear. my brother is also it's a huge part of my life. And because I've been working on a story about his life forever and called Monk Junk. And it's because my brother, hugely influencing, because when we were younger, we lived in Woodland Hills, but in the 70s, but there was also a lot of drugs and a lot of crazy things. And people wanting to get out of the valley. And my brother was sort of evolved into a very smart, junkie. You know, he was a heroin addict for a really long time. And so when the story of how he became a monk and has now been a monk and lived in Korea for almost 20 years, and now he lives in a New York, upstate New York Zen Center, a Korean Zen Center for years. That's a very profound influence for me. He's still the same person. And I kind of grew up with all that difference, you know, like, oh my God, wait. And when I tell the story, yeah, my brother was a heroin addict turned Zen monk. It's crazy. It's like, well, it really is how I learned a lot about Buddhism from like front and center, and a lot about change, you know, really profound change. And we're still in touch every day. It's not as simple as probably most people know that monks don't all look and sound and act alike, you know, like, oh, he's just so Zen. You know, it's like, it's a practice, but it doesn't mean you're also an asshole. Doesn't mean you're also weird. You know, it doesn't mean you get off the rails, you know, but you have to, that practice. So, you know, my brother's a big part of my life, and thankfully we're just still sharing a lot of stuff.
As you were growing up, you've said that you didn't know what graphic design was, but in high school, you realized you liked what the school newspaper and the magazine looked like.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the boy in school and his use of the word typography?
Yeah, I didn't know, and no one knew what typography, what is that? No one knew graphic design, but we were doing the paper, and at the time, I took a lot of, you know, kind of, I don't know, it was like, oh, I'm the youngest girl editor, you know, da, da, da. But what I just noticed is I was just really into the construction of it, what it looked like, how you brought up words and pictures and all that stuff. So anyway, yeah, this guy just said, wrote it across the thing, like a love note, you know, like, you know, your typography is so fine or whatever that, you know, something like that, you know. And it really struck me because it stuck on me, and I kind of saved that thing. And I just thought, what does that really mean? Of course, the idea of it being a landscape is cool. It just feels really good. And I'm like, you know, whatever he really meant, maybe he's smarter than I thought. At the time, I remember going like, oh, that's not typography. You know, kind of figuring out that's not really what he meant and going,
it's
okay, you're dumb.
Typography, not topography.
Yeah, right, you dumbass, you know, you don't know, you know. But also just being flattered by whatever he thought it was something that was noticeable, you know.
Right.
And it was just about scale. When I think about it now, I remember just, you know, those basic things. Creating scale, creating that pop, creating some kind of balance. And I also love type, and I like the way words looked. And I probably that was the beginning of that, you know.
Yeah, we have
and
that
yeah,
in
topography.
Common.
Now I just like that. It's like, yeah. It is the landscape of things, you know. Yeah.
In 1982, you went on to start an MFA at RISD, but left before you graduated. How come?
With respect to everyone involved, I thought it was more conservative than I imagined. And this sounds so arrogant now, or I think my thoughts must have been, are now even in retrospect, deeply arrogant. But I just thought, whoa, wait a minute, this is just not really very what's happening. And I didn't really know what was happening, but I knew it was just kind of, it just seemed old-timey. And so I did leave, and I kind of like regret a little bit because of the arrogance, you know, and not that it's just that, because I think about now as I've taught for many years and all that, and I think, damn. But I just thought, oh, wait, that's not what I meant. You know, it's kind of corporate-y and logo-y and I don't know what. And I thought, I think there's more.
You didn't go back to get your MFA until the early 90s when you went to Cranbrook.
Yeah.
After leaving RISD, you began teaching at Otis College of Art and Design in Los Angeles. And it was there that you met Scott Makala and described it in the following way. One day we were standing there while critiquing a student, and I remember nothing more or less than the feeling of falling upward. He literally had a white glow around him, kind of like an energy field. He could have been a UFO for all I know, but the feeling was mutual because he actually began to talk so fast that he stuttered. I knew my life had begun.
Oh my goodness, you've made me cry. Because that really happened like that. You know what I mean? It was,
yeah,
it was so visceral.
Once in a lifetime, and it's so magical. So it was really love at first sight, like just instant.
Yeah. Wow. He was really special. And yeah, he was just had a, such an physical energy. And I've other people feel that around him, you know, or when they knew he had so much charisma and kind of the energy field was, but I felt it between us and it just was instant and awesome. Yeah.
April Greiman once described your combination as upper body, meaning you, and lower body, meaning Scott. And you've said that you always liked that description of your grafted hybrid union, but added that it also depended on where you stand. Yeah. And I wanted to know what you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, it's just so funny. It's just sometimes you just feel like, no, I'm going to be the dancer today. You know, I've got my hips going here, or that's a brilliant idea. I'm going to do this. I think it can, it can flip either way. Mm. And maybe I was just jealous because he was just so kind of like, and when I say sexy, I don't just mean in every ordinary way. I mean, just in a thinking way, you know, just like that, really, you know, just always surprising. And yeah. Anyway, so the upper and lower, that's funny. But I also, someone recently said to me, it's a guy who's a Democrat, but he's married to a Republican. I said, whoa, that's a really weird, that must be difficult right now to even have a conversation, to watch TV together or anything. And he said, you know what, I've always believed in the two-party system. And I thought, and at first I thought, wait a minute, he's off topic. And then I realized he just meant even in a relationship, there is such thing as a two-party system. And Scott and I really had it. It's like, which is why when he died, I felt like it was really hard to keep doing anything. And that's my problem. But I just, the two-party thing really worked for us. And it was just so deep and inspiring and everything. And then when it's gone, it's like just a big, dumb silence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about more of what you did together before he left the earth.
Yeah.
And then talk about how that happened.
Yeah.
When you first got together, doesn't even seem like the word, crashed into each other's lives. You began to teach together. You started a studio together. What made you decide to leave your teaching positions and go back to be taught and get your MFAs at Cranbrook?
Okay, so we were teaching at Otis, and also we were at CalArts, and Scott wanted to go to Cranbrook. And I'm going to tell you, the truth is he wanted to go, and I was like, well, I'm going too. And we're actually in the middle of a breakup because, you know, it was very explosive and very intense to live together. This is just before Cranbrook. So it's like, you know what, let's just split up for a bit. His mother was sick with Alzheimer's. My mother was sick with cancer. We just kind of like split up and said, take a break. And then I heard he was going to go, yeah, cool, cool. And I'm going to go to Cranbrook. And I said, really? Okay, me too. And then we just got back together and just did that. You know, we just went.
Oh, Lori, you're forgetting a really important part. Your mother died and he showed up on your doorstep even when you were broken up.
I feel like you're like in my head. Who told you that? Did I tell you?
I read it.
That's so funny. Oh my God. No, this is when, you know, one knows that your partner is like for reals. And so when we broke up, it wasn't like, I'll never see you again. It was just like, oh my God, you're so intense. You're changing my life. I don't know. Just go away for a bit, you know, and you have your things going with your, you know. So but we still kept in touch. And anyway, when my mom died, I called him and I swear he was at my door that night, and he was just there. Just, hey, baby. And that's when you just know, hey, baby. You know, that's it. And because he just knew this, that's, you know, he was there. You know, when people say, oh, you know, I'll always be there for you. And then he just was there. And that was a different, you know, of course, when you lose your family, and I'd already lost my dad, and I would soon to lose my other brother. And I mean, a lot of things were going on. But it's like he just was waiting for, you know, when someone is, I don't mean to say vulnerable, but kind of when one is just going, oh, Lord, whatever we got going, let's just put it together right now. Yeah. And he just came. And he's a good, you know, I was, now talking to you, I'm going to go, you know, he's a really good guy. It's like, he was a really good guy.
Yeah. Well, by the end of your first year at Cranbrook, you got married. You yeah. went to the Caribbean for your honeymoon. Right before graduation, you got an interview to become the design director at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. I read that you interviewed in a short dress with plastic grapes pinned to your chest while 8 months pregnant.
Yes, ma'am.
And you were offered the job on the spot.
Yes, ma'am. That was a rocking time. Yes. And that was Kathy Halbreich was the director of the Walker, and she is an awesome woman. And, you know, I just want to throw in that, you know, Kathy McCoy was at Cranbrook. She kind of set me up with interviewing there. And, you know, it was, these are the women who helped me kind of get there, because that was the most awesome situation. The working environment was unbelievable. But, yeah, I was 6 months pregnant. And can you believe that? It's like, I cannot believe that happened.
You then went to work in a beautiful modern studio at the Walker, hired lots of fantastic people, while Scott stayed home and took care of Carmela, who was just newborn at that time. That's quite progressive for that time to have a husband that would be willing to do that.
Yeah. And he was doing his, you know, just beginning his work. So he did the MCAD catalog during that time. So, yeah, that was amazing that he did that. And but also I have to say, just not to, but when I think about that, because I think about, again, with my daughter wanting to be home with, you know, and all these different choices, I had an exquisite job, but also I had an income and health care so that he could do that and he could also work at home. You know, so when you think about it, it's just all these, and I say to my daughter, you know, these are choices every couple just makes. It doesn't really matter who does what, just make these decisions and go for it, you know? And so I think it's incredible that he was the stay-at-home dad, but he's building his career, and that I had a cool job that I was able to start our family, you know?
Yeah. The design critic and journalist Peter Hall described your time at the Walker as one where you transformed its visual style from an unwavering adherence to the clinical international style into a remarkably flexible and unconventional approach that would set up the Walker to this day as one of the most innovative museums in terms of its design approach. Did you know you were doing that at the time? Did you just come in and shake everything up, or was it just a byproduct of your talent and sort of a way of engaging with the museum?
I think it was the time, you know, and the and like having Kathy and different talents and the openness to try. And I think we were just at the end of that era, because the Friedmans, you know, who did that modernist, were so good and so superb that it was, again, about that kind of cockiness to say, yeah, well, that's all great, man, that modernism, but watch this. You know, we're just going to, like, trash it for a bit. And I, so yes and no. I mean, I think we were aware that it was, there was a change, and I think Kathy, the director, wanted just experimenting. So that's the, like, to me, you know, that, and just having talent, such good designers would come, and because they knew they had opportunity to do really interesting things.
That was such an interesting time in graphic design history with the New York School and then the Cranbrook School and the West Coast School and the legibility wars.
Yes.
And
the
Massimo Vignelli sort of look and style versus the style of Ed Fella and David Carson and Scott and you. What was it like to live through a time, now looking back, that you could see as a defining moment in graphic design?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy to think? And because I feel lucky that I kind of tapped into all, I mean, it's kind of like the girl at school sort of knows everybody, but nobody. It's like, I'm really affiliated with Cranbrook, but also I'm really affiliated with CalArts, a little bit with Art Center, a little bit with USC, mostly West Coast, I guess. But so I felt like I had a lot of cool exposure. Or I guess the question is, yeah, okay, Scott was rocking it. It was technology. It was all of those things that were happening at once that was really fun. So it made it so anything was possible. It was all okay. And it's just not, I don't feel like it's like that now. I mean, I don't know what people are experiencing now, but it's like we're in another place. So it's a virtual thing and it's a whole different deal.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how design history views this time. But certainly the idea of, and I was talking to Steve Heller about this morning, and how, you know, his article, The Cult of the Ugly, really put a pin in the map of what graphic design was then. And that pin will be there forever.
Yeah.
Really highlighting a moment where how something could be viewed or read or perceived was separate from how it looked.
Yes. Yeah, that was really, I mean, I don't know if there's anything, I mean, now we just have different questions in the air. So it's just not like, I don't really care if someone uses crazy fonts or good fonts. I mean, I have an arsenal of like three fonts and it's good enough for me. I think someone like Scott wouldn't have really, there just had to be that certain kind of little crack in the concrete. And and I think when you asked me that about the Walker, I mean, it was expected at that time to just like make changes, get things going.
Yeah, they knew they were hiring, right?
Yeah. And so it wasn't like, oh, I don't know. You know, it's like, no, the whole idea. In fact, you know, that was the pressure of deconstructing modernism at a most exquisite modern museum that was done so beautifully in the blah, blah, all respect. It's like, you just have to go in without thinking too much. You know, otherwise it's really like, oh my God, no, I can't, you know, you just have to. And I think about when you asked me that, I think, wow, I just must have just went balls out and just said, let's go, you know, I don't know, but it was cool.
A typography and branding project for the Walker that you created with legendary typographer Matthew Carter was added to the design collection at the Museum of Modern Art in 2011. What was it like to work with Matthew, and what was the biggest thing you learned from him?
Oh, my goodness. When you think about openness, now, we had an email exchange that went on for some time and talking about ideas. And when you talk about breaking down modernism, he just got it, even though he is also just he just has this respected, legendary view. And we evolved this concept. And he just started sending us these samples of this type that you could, we call it these serifs, where you could take them on and off. And
the snap-off serifs. So how did that work? How did you do something that had a snap-on serif?
And that's
like
really, you have to ask him, because it was just brilliant. And what it was brilliant also, we had, again, designers working with me who just went, oh, I get this. And they just started doing design. They just started snap on, snap off, and you realize to have flexibility like that, it's just so natural. You just think, well, why not? And, you know, Andrew Blauvel was there for some time afterwards, and I don't know exactly if he carried on with that exact font, but the spirit of that just kept going and going and going, because there was so much flexibility and kind of ambiguity, and each designer was kind of responsible for, you know, anything could happen with that font, and it was really fun. But you had to have really talented people who understood how to use that program. But Matthew Carter would just come and hang out with everybody and talk about what he's trying, and the ideas were very collaborative. But in the end, again, it's his brilliance that went, how about like this? And then we had an open enough institution that said, yeah, we can handle that. Let's go. You know,
that's rare.
Yeah, really rare.
You and Scott became co-directors of the graphic design department and designers in residence at Cranbrook in 1997 and have written about how you jammed Carmela and your books and your flat files into the car, invited a few folks who were working with you to come along and return to Cranbrook. And at that point, you said that the Art Academy looked exactly like Hogwarts School of Witchcraft.
Yeah.
And in what way?
Have you ever been there?
I've been, yes.
You have,
yes.
You know what I mean?
But I haven't been to Hogwarts.
Oh my God, it's just so magical. And to me, it's like when we first got there, you know that scene when you're in a world of black and white, and then you kind of drive up there and then everything goes in color. It felt like that. It was the Hogwarts, but it's just this very magical place because, you know, people, we live there, as you know, we live there. Our students live there. We live there. Or I live there as students. We live there as faculty.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And you just feel like you're just, every corner is so new, like, oh my God, I never noticed that before. Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, Lori, I was there. Elliot Earls invited me to come to be an artist in residence for a few days. Mm. And I got to sit in on classes and participate in a whole bunch of events. And I think I maybe was there for 3 days. And at the end of the experience, and this was probably 10, 12 years ago, I was ready to give up everything, my corporate job, my home in Manhattan, and move to Cranbrook, to Michigan, to go to Cranbrook and get an MFA. That's how seductive,
right?
And charismatic and just so full of spinning atoms that,
yes,
that place is. It was unbelievable. I've never had that experience before.
Yes.
I was ready.
And I know you've been.
I've been to so many incredible schools, so many incredible environments and countries and places of education and worship. And I have to say that experience at Cranbrook was the only time I was ever like, I have to change my entire life right now.
Yeah. It's an astounding place. It really is. And I think it's still, it can't, and to have such a small community. And when I tell people, you know, it also is not just technology and design and blah, 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 and art, it's craft. That foundation, it's history. Like, people forget that that's still a real thing.
Yeah, I was also struck by the level of trust in student risk-taking, which I thought is a really important attribute to foster.
Well, it's almost like if you don't take a risk, you're like, you know, a wimp. You know, you just have to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's what scared most people there. They'd be just like, what I knew this more as watching my students is like what was making people quiver is like, oh my God, I have to just be so epically amazing every day. And I was like, hey man, you have 2 years. Just relax. Right. Nobody knows. Nobody's going to say anything. Nobody's watching. You've got 2 years to figure that shit out. And that's also the beauty, is just relax. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
You're growing a business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
You and Scott ran your own design studio at the same time, you called your company Pictures for Business and Culture, and you had clients like Nike and MTV really at the top of your game. Then one day, a few months after you arrived as the new designers in residence, you had a brain hemorrhage at 40 years old. And in your book, Where Is Here?, you write this about the experience. The hemorrhage followed three sequential orgasms in the ladies' room of a trendy restaurant in Soho, New York. That moment of extreme pleasure set off a congenital time bomb. A malformation of a tiny blood vessel exploded into a pool of blood in the left front hemisphere of my brain, like a gunshot inside my head. 24 hours later, I was surrounded by neurosurgeons, all surprised to see me still alive. Lori, after that experience, you've said that you could actually feel the thingness of thinking, the thingness of thinking. I'm wondering if you can share what that was like and how you were able to recover.
Well, okay, so I had Scott and I had Cranbrook, and these are communities that are like, help me recover. I'm just going to start there because I think in any other situation, it would have been harder. Well, because the part of the brain that was damaged was the left hemisphere, and the left hemisphere has to do with language and words, and so the day it happened, and when you have a brain hemorrhage, sometimes it doesn't just like, oh, I'm dead. It happens, and then you're just kind of tripping out, and it's slowly inside kind of blowing up. So in 24 hours, you could be dead. You're just kind of going like, okay, whoa. And then I was doing a conference and supposed to give a talk with Scott, and Lorraine Weil called me, or something like that. And I remember realizing that I had no idea how to write her name down or understand really what she was telling me. And this is an old, you know, when you start to go, oh, I have a nerve. I don't really know. You're telling me Lorraine, L-O-R-R, and I'm writing down X-Y, gicky. And that's when Scott was there and he was like, it's an ambulance. You know, there was this whole moment of going, what is this? Anyway, so the language part was huge, and memory and all those things. But, you know, I did recover, and I was in an environment that was allowed you to be a little bit like Cranbrook. How one thinks and does their work is your own business. And so when I think about those days, I think, whoa, I had a little kid, I had the brain thing, I had the whole instant, we just started, Scott was rocking out, he was traveling a lot, you know, he was doing his like Michael Jackson thing. I mean, everything was just crazy. Yeah. When I think back how we did that, I don't really know. When you asked me that, I really paused, I thought, I don't really know. I just think it was just so weird. And a lot of it just involved not being afraid and resting and getting used to this kind of bizarre. Slowly you recover the brain. And the reason why I kind of take a pause is because, you know, I had a second one, and that's when she hit the fan. So the first one.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, definitely. And the first one was really just like, oh, this is freaky and this is really scary. But because I survived, you know, but I was told at the time you have a 50-50 chance of having a second brain hemorrhage. And I don't know why, but I was just like still kind of had that, we're cool, you know, I'm good. You know, and I don't know what I thought, but I just went, carry on.
In thinking about the publication of your book, Where Is Here?, which is where I read that quote from, you've said that you wished you'd focused your interest in sexuality in a more direct way in making that book. How so?
I think, Scott, when you talk about the desire to take risks, you know, there's that. And I think how that book was constructed, for better or for worse, the risks were there. But I thought that the part that people didn't really know, or we weren't really going for, is that, and when I say sexuality, I don't mean like weird sex. I just mean when sexuality is a big part of your life together and what you think is is good to just send out to the world as a beautiful thing. You know, like kind of like Nick. I mean, I just called Scott Nick. Nick is the name of my son. That was weird. But Scott, if he could have been like a Prince guy, he'd be Prince. You know, where just just let it roll. And then, and that's what I guess I meant, is that it's sort of like, well, you know, we didn't just really roll out the whole, all things that we find kind of amazing and whatever.
Well, there were some really interesting images. One of the images that I was struck by was the contribution that Stefan Sagmeister made, which was the close-up. I couldn't figure it out at first. I was looking at it. I'm like, oh my God, that's a close-up, really, really tight close-up of a hanging testicle.
Right.
And then, of course, I was like, I wonder if it is. And I didn't ask him, and I should.
Well, you know, he'll probably remember the story differently, whatever, but I just remember we were like, Stefan, we're doing this book, can you contribute? Because all of these people, we just wanted contributions from all over the world, all the weird stuff that we liked, and we kind of taunted him. I remember it this way, taunting him to do something completely extreme like that, and maybe Scott said, you know, just like, put your balls out, man, you know, whatever. I don't know, but something like that. Or maybe he remembers it differently. But anyway, yeah, there they were. And they're just, and of course, with Stefan's work, I don't know him well, but I'm assuming we don't always know if that's him or not, and this and that. But it seems like, well, why not?
And yeah, and I can't imagine
you know, why not? And I just figured, thank you, you know?
Yeah, it's just the one hanging testicle, very close up. You see all the little curly hairs.
Yeah.
I stared at it for quite some time.
And just go,
really,
what is this?
And, by it.
And
yeah.
Then you get to looking at it so long, you just think it should look like that. Just one
is
good.
Yeah, yeah. Especially once you figure it out.
Yeah,
once
and then you're just like, one is fine, thank you.
They're so interesting. Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at them.
Yeah,
so,
I think Scott, better. I mean, now that I think about it, because there was just an intensity, and we haven't defined, like you say, sexuality, but there just was this almost joyfulness around it. That's what it was for him, and also just kinkiness and weird. I mean, there was all that stuff that is fun about sex, and I think that's why I thought we could have gone further in some way, you know.
Well, we're up to about May of 1998 in talking about your life, Lori, and at this point, your husband Scott is a media design rock star. He has spiked blonde hair, blue eyes, what's referred to as a Brad Pitt smile. He wore black jeans and black t-shirts and Oakley wraparound sunglasses. He just returned home after a month working in Brazil. His design for the opening sequence for Fight Club was in production. Spring graduation was a week away, and he had just nailed a year-long contract with an international snowboarding company. You write about how at that moment you were in love and living in utopia. And then one night he goes to sleep, wakes up at 3 a.m, wakes you up and tells you he is afraid if he falls asleep, he won't wake up. And shortly thereafter, he dies. How on earth did you manage?
It's still astounding, isn't it?
It's astounding. He had a very rare disease that caused his death, and you had no knowledge that it was something that he had until it was too late.
Well, and actually, I don't even know if that's the disease he had. It was so kooky because at the time they were saying, oh, it's epiglottitis, da, da, da. But a couple things happened. You know, he came home with a kind of a ear infection. He took some medicine. He went home, felt better after the medicine. We went to bed. And about 3 a.m, he couldn't breathe. And I'm thinking, oh, he's got the medicine, we're good, you know. And anyway, this one thing led to, he just suddenly said, I got to take a shower, I can't, you know, my whole, oh. And then all of a sudden, of course, it's just like, fucking, you know, we're call the ambulance, da-da-da-da. It was kind of chaotic, but the ambulance people, they kind of just hung around instead of taking him directly. It was like, oh, maybe you're just kind of this, it's kind of that. And And believe it or not, what I've learned recently from his sister, she told me recently, she says, you know, Lori, the epiglottitis thing, that was a guess by the doctor. He was given the wrong medicine by the ambulance people on the way to the hospital. So he died on the way to the hospital.
Right.
And so by the hospital, of course, revived him. He was all going up, but he had no brain activity for a couple of days. I don't really know. I honestly still don't really know what happened, but it happened so fast. He was just saying goodnight to everybody. There's just a beautiful guy. And then it was over, just like that.
You've written about how the EMT guys seemed unusually slack. You mentioned it here, asking you questions while Scott's airway slowly closed shut. Do you think, and I don't know if it's wise to go down this would have, could have, should have path, but do you think if he had been treated differently, if they had taken him to the hospital right away, he could have survived?
Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's so fucked up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so one asked this, you know, to be honest, I have to say to myself, wait, I was sitting there. It just seems so crazy. You know, when your friends like cough, cough, da, 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 you don't think about it. I mean, I'm looking for his tennis. I'm just not thinking that this is it. I knew there was something. I called the ambulance. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, had I just actually put him in the car myself right away? That's a horrifying thought, right? But what I did instead is I called the ambulance because I thought an ambulance knows what to do.
Yeah.
So when, you know, I track back and go, whoa, that was such a nanosecond of decision making. And I thought calling the ambulance and trusting whatever was going on there was the thing to do. And I also just thought, this is not anything extreme. Even when we went to the, as he was on the way, I went in another car because they were like, we're good, you know, like you go because you're going to want to drive him home or something like that. I don't know. And I'm thinking, yeah, I got to get his stuff so I can drive him home, you know, in 2 hours. You know, you're just thinking this is just a blip.
Right.
You can't even imagine. I mean, I know this isn't your quote or anything, but my kids and I have this thing like, man, never, ever go to bed with anything else but love for the person you're with because you just don't know. And Scott and I had a lot of that. We never went to bed mad. You know, it wasn't like that. We're all like, in fact, you know, in that story I say,
yeah,
the last thing is like, can I have a blowjob, baby? And I love that because that is so Scott. That's what I mean. It's
right.
Like, and I'm like, too tired. And I don't have regret for not giving that blowjob. I mean, a little bit, but kind of not really. Because we had our fine times. You know, when you go like,
right.
Okay. And that's honestly just to, I don't know, is I had a lot of love and just full imagination and everything with Scott. And that's why I just feel like when people say, oh, you know, do you ever want to marry again or whatever? It's like when you've had a lot of love, just solid, you're okay. You know what I mean? You don't have to search for more because that was a pretty solid experience, you know?
Yeah. You've talked about how telling stories is therapeutic, especially when it comes to grief, and have said that you've not moved on, but you moved in to your widowhood. How have you done that?
Well, you are very, you probably know that I got married a second time.
Yes.
And so
Ronald,
you do different. Yes, Ronald Jones. And you do see that one does different things to try to get away from your widowhood and just go, okay, a whole new thing. And also a very intelligent, passionate person. And like, okay, let's see how this thing fits. And the truth is, there's only one time a shoe really fits really good. So that was a chapter.
Yeah.
The Ronald chapter was sort of like when you asked me, I thought to myself, had I just stuck with, I'm just going to stay with my widowhood, but I didn't, you know, I tried to kind of get it.
I think that's a way to try to soothe yourself.
Yes.
I mean, I had a second divorce that was really, really hard. And it took me 5 years to get over it, really. And I did all sorts of terrible self-destructive things in that 5 years with all sorts of terrible self-destructive people. And, you know, I look back at that 5 years and think, holy shit, was I in pain.
Yes. You know what? I appreciate you saying that because time with Ron while, you know, he passed away last year. And so, and he's a, again, he's a fabulous person and as a professor and all these things. But the time and stuff, we lived together in Stockholm, and that time was really hard for a lot of reasons. And can I stop right there?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Hard for a lot of reasons.
I was like, wait, where was I going there?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how much you want to talk about your second brain hemorrhage, but you were in Sweden working.
You had
a company. You were doing really extraordinary work. You were doing a lot of fine art at that point. You were doing exhibitions. And then you had another hemorrhage in the same part of the brain while you were teaching.
Yeah.
And you said this about the experience. After that, I couldn't read or write. I didn't know the difference between the letter A and my left foot. I said tree, but I meant refrigerator. Numbers didn't make sense. Later, I learned that brain injuries like mine cause communication problems with three lyrical names: asphasia, difficulties with speech, agraphia, difficulties with writing, and alexia, difficulties with reading. And you had all three. You had seizures in the street. You had brain surgery. How are you still alive?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it is astounding that I just feel like I'm kind of a poster, that the brain just heals itself. It can. I don't mean to sound suddenly like our president going, "You're just crazy. I'm cured," but what it is you learn about compensation and about patience. There's a lot of ways to compensate, but anyway. But it took me a long time. So when I don't know, I feel like I had about 10 or more years of just kind of a blank spot.
Wow.
But my kids were also young, so I was going through a divorce. And I came back to the States, so it was kind of a very hard blank time, you know, in terms of, you know, when I love people professionally who can just block through their professional career, like da da da, you know, and then I did this, then I did that, and da da da, and you know, when you have just these things that happen in your life, that it's like, no, everything just has to stop, and you have to, your career and all these things that you think are super important are just not right now. Yeah. So Sweden was where I recovered, and I was grateful. I was living with Ron, and he was very helpful, and, you know, because I had my kids there. But a lot of it in Sweden, thank you, Sweden, is I was in rehabilitation for many months, and occupational therapy, where you kind of learn things you already knew again. And I have to say, I was very, it was a really fearful time. I was afraid of just what was happening, you know, how, when you feel like you're stuck in a situation, you can't, how did you get here? And, you know, whether it's a marriage or a country or a health problem or anything, you just feel so vulnerable and so much like, okay, I get it. I'm starting at ground zero, but where is that ground? And I got to get out of this. I knew I needed to leave. So, I mean, it was very, you know, you have those times where you think, wow, how did I?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if I've said this before too, or whatever, but I would say to my brother, or my brother said to me, the Zen monk, he said, "Lori, when you left Sweden, it was like you put your son on your back and you just started swimming home." And that's true. I don't remember how I did it. I didn't have any money. I didn't have anything. The marriage, the divorce was like, dude, let's just say it's okay and bye-bye. You know, like, you know, let's not work out the anything finite, out of care, you know. And it was just, it was starting over, and I don't know what age I was, but I was definitely in my 50s. I mean, it was just like, how did I get here? And that's my dog. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, I thought I took him for a long walk.
I love when we hear dogs and cats on the air with us.
So this is like, you've been on the phone long enough, Mom. Okay, wherever we were, yeah.
When you were in the hospital, you were told you couldn't run a graduate program and do numerous projects at once ever again. You were told you'd have to see yourself in a new way, and that way was slow. It was the opposite of the way you previously lived.
Yeah.
What were you imagining for your future? Did you think that you'd be able to recover as well as you have?
No, that's what I guess I was saying about fear. You know, you alternate between going, I should be able to do that, and to just I just can't. I didn't have the confidence, you know? Yeah, it changed me. Because when you also, you can't trust your language, you know? And
yeah.
In a way, though, it's such a humbling thing. Your life has to get really simple. You know, doing one thing a day is just fine. What I've learned from occupational therapy or having a really severe brain injury is that actually one can recover, but it's going to be different. And just the difference is good. You know, I mean, I just don't need to do as many things. And also I'm older, so what? You know, it's just different.
I read that you were required to relearn signs and symbols, and that forced you to internalize design as a survival method. And I thought that was really interesting. How were you able to do that?
Well, don't you think that arranging things, organizing ideas, putting things in a certain way so that you remember it or other people remember it in a way, isn't that design is, I mean, I think every designer, don't we all talk about how design is just a way of living and a way of organizing your thinking and a way of organizing your physical space and everything? So maybe that's what I meant, is that, because I feel that the better, and I still, when I say the better I get, because I still feel like I'm recovering, because I still have a lot of little glips and glaps that come up. But it's still design, and having old friends like Lorraine Wilde or April Grime or these, you know, Kathleen Nikitas, these people I've known for 30 years in different ways and different times in our life. And they've been there, like when I came back to LA and I was so insecure, just like, you know, can I? Anyway, I just felt like there was this sense of like, the thinking is the same. I just felt like people understand that illness or change, it doesn't make you, now you're not that smart or you're not that designer or now you're not an artist. That's just kind of impossible. Maybe that's what I learned. It's like certain things that are just in your system and you've grown up with it in every which way. It's just part of how, where you recover to or the place you go to feel better. And I will say that there was a time where I thought, I just can't think that carefully anymore. I don't have that kind of multidisciplinary head anymore. Oh my God, oh my God. And the truth is, if I just relax and take my time, it's the same. You don't lose whole cognitive things. I mean, you do a little bit here and there, but I feel like I'm better in a weird way. It took me 10 years, whatever, to say that, but it's like, oh, if that's what it takes to slow down and not care, like, I'm sure you have certain projects that you think, oh my God, I'm never going to finish that, or no, I'm not really capable of doing that, I'm not, da-da-da. And I've come to find out through these little moments in life that, you know, Lori, you can if you just give it time, and if it takes 10 years, that's okay, just relax. And in that other part, when we started, and I was telling you about my daughter, a lot of that is about speed. You know, if you're in the film industry, it's like speed and change and again and do it again and da-da-da-da. I'm like, so don't care. That, you know, I live with my garden. I just live in a very different place. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine how hard you've worked to impact your healing. You're now currently teaching again for the Academy of Art University, San Francisco. You were appointed the first designer in residence at the University of Southern California, Roski School of Art and Design. And one of your most recent projects, it's quite an extraordinary project, was working with Sarah Schluning. Is that
Schluning.
Correct? Did
yeah.
I say it right?
Yeah, it's Schluning. Hard to say. Yeah, okay. But yeah, yeah.
Who was a senior curator of arts and design at the Dallas Museum of Design. And you helped create an exhibit, participated in a show, created the show's identity, and designed the exhibition book for a show titled Speechless, Different by Design. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Seen the work. It's magnificent.
Thanks.
Can you tell us a little bit about the show and how it came to be?
Oh, dear. Yeah. I mean, that's such a beautiful example of if you just wait and be patient and the right thing comes back to you. And if you're ready to grab it, you know, and I just thought I would never have that. I really didn't. I just didn't think that would happen again. But Sarah, we met briefly 20 years ago at Cranbrook. She was a young curator and I was teaching there, but she's told me when we met, I was really grieving Scott. So she said, you were just in it. She was telling me, she says, you might not remember meeting me because you were in a very deep space, you know, just a gone space. But anyway, she remembers. So I bring up Cranbrook because it's those connections. It's like a family. We met 20 years ago briefly, but she called me and suggested this project. And I was so still convinced that I was not ready for a complex project that I just blew it right. The minute she was talking to me, I was thinking, not only is this the most awesome project I've ever, it's like, you know, like you're speaking my language. I was freaking out, but also I was so scared that I was not really ready for it. And oh my God, did I even have a printer that was working right? You know, that type of thing, that I said no. And she just kept saying, it's okay, don't worry about it. You know what, just come to Dallas and we're going to just meet with the other artists and it's going to be cool. And I literally gave her other names to say, I would send her another email saying, I don't think you heard me. I'm like saying, no, here, check out blah, blah, blah. And I'm giving these different names. And she just kind of went, oh, did you send me an email? What? And I realized that she just had this intuitive sense of why certain people come together to do a project, even though you don't know what the outcome's going to be. So she invited me. We got together in Dallas with the other artists. The neuroscience, she brought all these scientists that have to do with neurological thinking and difference, you know, people who don't necessarily have language skills, but they are highly, you know, tactile or what, you know, we heard a lot of stories and a lot of information and stuff like that for a couple of days. And then I walked away from that and going, oh my God, this is the project of a lifetime for me.
The exhibition, it feels like it intentionally rejected the status quo. And Sarah has stated that everything that that you all did was about the least conventional choice. And what happens if we try not to use words? What happens if we don't do interpretive text, but use pictures or videos? Yeah. What happens if we make sensory deep impression spaces? You also gave the exhibition its title. Let's talk about the word speechless. In the exhibit book, there's a reference to a conversation with a linguist. And the linguist said, when you have a word that ends in L-E-S-S, less, that's a negative. So watch out. Why did you decide to use it anyway? What was your response?
Well, I'll give you her name later, but because I super respect her. And it was just a very epic thing that she was kind of shooting off ideas. And she said that, and I knew it was coming from a smart place. But I just felt like speechless is like awesome. And it felt positive. It didn't feel negative. You know, when you just know that something is like, oh, I know that's a bad name for my baby, but whatever.
But it was grandma's name, and so we've got to stick with it.
Yeah, that's just what it's going to be. And also because Sarah tells the story about her son who at the time he just didn't speak at all and how frustrating that was. And so when I said, what about speechless? And I was afraid that she might find it too close to the bone, you know, like too much like, you know, I don't want to go there. But she really embraced it. And she said, that is it. Let's just go speechless. And I just somehow that, you know, as you know, when you name something, it gives it heft.
Significance, right?
Yeah. And it's like, you know, and then next step, you start creating its visual identity. Sarah is brilliant. And she kind of led me down that path. Like, she was the sort of person who would, when we started doing the design of the book cover and it was going to be for Yale, and I got all tripped out thinking, oh, Yale, it's got to be this way and that way and da, da, da. And she just did that same trick that beautiful curators do. She said, oh, that's kind of big, isn't it, Lori? And she knows that I'm just the quieter, the smaller, that just like back off. And so the cover ended up with that, just that one, you know, like the most minimal. But that was, you know, when you're working with somebody who just has really helped you kind of get to the place you were meant to be without yes. telling you what to do, but just kind of letting you kind of fall upward is all my favorite, but it's just that am I falling up or down right now? You know, it was cool. It was good.
But the book, the cover is it velvet?
It's, oh, what was the name of that fabric?
It feels very velvety.
Velvety,
it's so
yeah.
sumptuous and sexy.
No,
it's,
I know. We were working with the printers.
Definitely a keep it by the bed kind of book.
Right. And you don't have to read it. I promise you. It's just cozy. And that was really when Sarah said to me, what do you want this book to feel like? You know, and I kept saying, I just want it to feel like you just want to hold it and put it in bed with you and just be cozy. And when we were working with the printer, of course, you know, you get all these kind of generic stocks for covers, stuff like that. And I said, oh, guys, you know, isn't there anything just velvety and sexy and da-da-da? And they found, you know, of course, printers are just great. And they just come up with, and they went like this. And I was like, yeah, like that. And yeah, that was really nice that came together.
Well, congratulations. That the whole project is just so on point. It really is. It's just an absolutely gorgeous project.
But if I have a moment to say, I don't talk about this in my talk because we wanted to keep it very precious, you know, about speechless. But you know that that exhibition was open when COVID came out, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's open. We're rocking out. We're supposed to travel to, you know, Atlanta.
The Hyde Museum, right?
Yeah. Everything's going on. COVID comes out and we have a show about touching and getting close to everything and like leaning in. And so, of course, not only did the museum, like every other museum in the country, close, but then we had to ponder like, well, is this going to travel still? What does this mean? And it's heartbreaking, really, because everything about that show about touch, like when we talk about the book, now, you know, it's a touch thing, but one thing Sarah kept telling me, even before COVID, is, so that exhibition won't travel. I mean, it was just kind of this shitty thing that happened where everything about what you're trying to do is that it's, you just can't. People aren't going to go in to all jam together in a place and breathe anyway. But what was cool is that Sarah said to me, you know, Lori, the thing about a book is that whatever we do in the exhibition, that's a temporary thing. It's over. She said, what matters is the book, and the book is the process of every other, you know, the other artists and the thinking and everything like that. So after COVID, the book even became more kind of special to me because it's like, yeah, you're right. There will now not be an exhibition, most likely, because even the things in the show, like people who design things where a kid had to go up to that glass thing and touch it and breathe next to it and whatever, they have to redesign their work anyway,
right?
You know, forever. And so everybody was kind of like, well, but the book gets to stay the book. And that was kind of special. I thought, whoa, just when we just for a second there thinking that books are kind of like iffy, it's like, no, they count.
Lori, I want to ask you one last thing. I want to talk to you about the term graphic design. About 20 years ago, you stated that graphic design has always been a kind of iffy title for our discipline. As an undergraduate at Berkeley, it was called visual communications, and somehow graphic designer just meant you weren't really an artist. Graphic design seemed to mean only type an image on a flat surface, preferably with a client. As technologies and intentions changed over the last 20 years, especially, graphic design has been broadened into terms like design thinking, visual storytelling, and digital humanities, and so on. What do you think of the evolution of graphic design and the work that is being made now?
I think the work is evolving in such a galactic speed, you know, in terms of how it's using technology and virtual experience.
Reality and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, my son's into virtual reality stuff like that. So I'm kind of realized that there's this whole other world that is also equal but different. So anyway, I just figure that people will continue to make up new words for what it is, and I'm okay with that. It's not my job anymore. You know, when you're involved in institutions, you think it's your job to name things like that. But I'm pretty okay with graphic design again, which is funny after all these years, just because, you know, whatever technology we're using and whatever, it's still certain qualities feel that way. I still work with words and image, but my technologies are different. Yeah, so I don't really care anymore. And I figure there's a whole other game going on that I'm not aware of. So, you know, yeah.
Lori Haycock Makala, thank you for creating such beautiful multi-sensory work. Thank you for showing us what true resilience is. And thank you for joining me on this very special episode of Design Matters for the Bend Design Conference in Bend, Oregon.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure. Thank you.
Lori Haycock Makala's work can be seen in the latest book she designed called Speechless, Different by Design, and it is a work of art. This is the 16th year we've been podcasting Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced for the TED family of podcasts by Curtis Fox Productions. In non-pandemic times, the show is recorded at the School of Visual Arts Masters in Branding program in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Zachary Pettit, and the art director is Emily Weiland.